Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, May the 8th. Hello and welcome to Africa Link. My name is Abubakar Jalo.
With me, Jane Ayeko Kumet in Bonn, Germany. In today's program, more African countries are in serious debt despite the overall economic growth in the continent. That's according to the new report by the International Monetary Institution, IMF.
Countries in sub-Saharan Africa have large infrastructure gaps and development needs. And many countries in the region had the space, fiscal space, to borrow and build that infrastructure.
And the debt toll from flooding in Kenya, Tanzania and Rwanda is rising. What's the meteorological explanation for it?
This is not El Nino related, by the way, yet they are normally what we call systems that give rise to different weather patterns. There is what we call Madden-Julian oscillation that has been in the phase that normally gives us heavy rainfall for quite some time.
That's Peter Ambenje, head of Kenya's Institute for Meteorological Training and Research. We'll be speaking to him a little later.
These are just some of the stories, plus your thoughts, live on our Facebook page, DW Africa. But before that, let's hear some of the stories that are making headlines around the world.
This is DW News with me, Crispin Mwakideu. U.S. President Donald Trump has told French President Emmanuel Macron that he is abandoning the Iran nuclear deal, according to the New York Times. Trump reportedly also said the U.S. will reimpose all sanctions that had previously been lifted as part of the deal, which was meant to curb Iran's nuclear program. Iran's central bank chief Valiola Saif, however, downplayed the prospect of a return to sanctions, saying the country's economy is stable.
We are prepared, and this will not have an impact on our economy. We will be able to move forward, and there's no need to be concerned.
Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the roadside bomb attack that claimed the lives of 9 Kenyan soldiers near the Kenya-Somalia border on Sunday. In the wake of the blast, an intelligence report released by the Kenyan security agencies warned of more attacks and called for vigilance. Al-Shabaab declared war on Kenya after it deployed forces to help stabilize the Horn of Africa nation in 2011. The Democratic Republic of Congo has confirmed 2 cases of Ebola in the northwestern town of Bikoro. Health officials say there were at least 10 other suspected cases of the deadly virus. An outbreak of Ebola in December 2013 killed 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. You're listening to DW News from Bonn, Germany. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hit out at a French manifesto calling for certain passages of the Quran to be removed. Addressing party supporters in Ankara this Tuesday, Erdogan questioned an open letter signed by 300 well-known French personalities who called on prominent Muslims to denounce anti-Jewish and anti-Christian reference in the Quran.
Bunu söyleyenlerin Kur'an-ı Kerim'den...
It's clear that those who have said this have no idea about the Quran, but have they even read their own book, Bible? Or have they even read the Torah? Or the Psalms? If they have read it, they would probably ask for the Bible to be banned, but they have no such concern.
Böyle bir sorunu, böyle bir derdi asla yok.
Relations between Turkey and the West have been tense following the July 2016 failed coup, with Western nations accusing Erdogan of limiting basic freedoms. While governing body FIFA has fined Russia's Football Association 30,000 Swiss francs, that approximately 25,000 euros, following racist chants by supporters during a friendly between World Cup host and France in March. Manchester United midfielder Paul Pogba and Barcelona winger Ousmane Dembele were the target of monkey chants during the match, which ended in a 3-1 victory for France in St. Petersburg. And finally, a story that sounds like it was taken straight out of a comedy show. Suspected car thieves fleeing police in South Africa drove straight into the grounds of a notorious maximum security prison. Police say the carjackers, who have been dubbed the dumbest criminals by local media, drove their stolen car into Pulsmoor Prison, which once held former president and anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela. For more news and information, visit dw.com. I'm Crispin Mwakideu.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program with me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I am Abubakar Jalo. Remember, we are live on Facebook, so make your voice count and share your comments and opinion on some of the stories we are covering. We'll definitely get to some of them.
And we start the program with the just-released outlook report by the International Monetary Fund that projects a plateau in some countries despite a faster pace of economic growth in 2018. It projects a raise to 3.4% this year, up from 2.8% in 2017. But at the same time, the report points to a growing number of countries in debt, distress, or at a risk of it.
So African nations are constantly borrowing money despite its vast wealth in natural resources, and donors are continuously willing to lend money. Is it as plain as it sounds?
Well, that's exactly the question I put to Papa Ndiaye, division chief of the regional studies in the African Department of IMF, and this was his response.
What we are seeing is that countries in sub-Saharan Africa have large infrastructure gaps and development needs. And many countries in the region had the fiscal space to borrow and build that infrastructure and to invest in both human and physical capital that's needed for the countries to grow and meet UN sustainable development goals. Many of the countries in the region are oil exporting countries that have been hit by a severe oil price shock. You also have a set of countries that have been going through long-standing conflict or that have been affected by security issues that needed to have been through severe economic hardship.
The report also highlights about 40% of low-income countries, including Chad, Eritrea, Mozambique, Congo Republic, South Sudan, and Zimbabwe, as being in debt distress. Now, how did they fall into this debt?
Many of these countries are oil exporting countries or commodity exporting countries that have suddenly been faced by a large unanticipated shock. So all the cases are conflict cases with countries that have long-standing political and economic issues that underpin this deterioration.
Ethiopia has been registering double-digit growth and was seen as Africa's biggest performing economy. Now comes this report that's labeling it as one in high risk of debt distress. What criteria did you use to come up with this conclusion?
Basically, we go through a comprehensive set of assessment of all the indicators in the countries and look at from a forward-looking perspective the future borrowing plans of the governments to come up with an assessment. But I think in many of the countries that are growing very fast in sub-Saharan Africa, 6% or more, and Ethiopia is one of them, the growth has been driven primarily by public investment that public investment was financed through debt. There the challenge is really to be able to hand over the reins of growth to the private sector.
Papa Ndiaye, Division Chief, Regional Studies in the African Department of the IMF, responding or rather clarifying the report that has just been released.
And the response here from Massa Putin via our WhatsApp platform, saying the IMF is criticizing the heavy borrowing because those countries are borrowing from China and not the IMF.
That's interesting. And he kind of raised a conversation there. If you go to our Facebook book page, you'll certainly see how much his comment was. But then he attracted a response from Sir Wanyonyi, who said, well, there is empirical evidence and a number of perfect case studies to show how public debt exerts a bog on macroeconomics. And he highlights Greece as one of the evident cases on that one.
And the final one from Niam Mba says the IMF is an organization created to keep weak nations enslaved economically. An interesting comment there.
Yes, keep your comments coming. We shall certainly present them if time allows us. But first, we go to the US. Now, President Donald Trump said he will announce a decision on the future of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal later today. Trump has repeatedly said Iran hasn't confirmed to the agreement. He has signaled that the U.S. may pull out unless European signatories agree to revise the deal.
Meanwhile, a senior Iranian official said on Tuesday that Iran will not accept any demands on top of those it agreed to in its nuclear deal with the world powers. This announcement comes hours before President Trump says he's going to make his decision. Dagmar Breitenberg has more.
Slamming the nuclear deal with Iran has been one of Donald Trump's fieriest mottos before and after taking office.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it. Believe me.
On Monday, the U.S. president announced on Twitter he was ready to deliver his verdict. Whether he will call for the end of the deal or push for a renegotiation is not clear. Under the 2015 agreement, Iran was to limit its nuclear program, specifically its uranium enrichment, in exchange for relief from international economic sanctions. The deal, struck under the Obama administration, united global powers. The U.S., China, Russia, Germany, France, the U.K., and the European Union put their name to it. Now pressure is piling up on Washington to stay in the accord, including from Germany's Foreign Minister Heiko Maas.
We remain convinced that this agreement will make the world a safer place. We are afraid that a failure will lead to escalations, and we drop back into the years before 2013, something which nobody can have interest in.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron were in Washington to speak to President Trump. On Monday, the UK's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson also arrived in Washington in last-minute diplomatic efforts to deter the US administration from scrapping the deal.
We think we can fix all that. Working with our European friends, we think we can be tougher on Iran, but not throw away that the heart of the deal, which is all about stopping them getting a nuclear weapon.
European leaders say they're open to finding compromise, but the existing framework must remain untouched. But in spite of Europe's promises to address Trump's complaints, many fear the U.S. president has made up his mind.
Dagmar Breitenbach.
With that report. Now, weeks of torrential rains after a long drought have turned from a blessing to a curse in East Africa, killing hundreds of people and displacing hundreds of thousands more. In Kenya, which had three failed rainy seasons, 120 people have died.
Now, from a meteorological perspective, where does the problem lie? A question I put to Peter Abenje, Director General of the Institute for Meteorological Training and Research in Nairobi.
What I can say is that I think we've had a fairly heavy rainfall across much of Kenya, for example, including parts of other countries like Rwanda and Tanzania. And I think one of the observations is that the heavy rainfall events have been persistent. They have been recurring more often than we have seen before. And this is what has been caused fairly heavy flooding in a number of areas.
And to what extent of damage has this caused, especially on agriculture in Kenya, Tanzania and Rwanda?
Well, let me talk about Kenya because I don't know exactly what has happened in Tanzania and Rwanda, but what I know is that in some of the areas we've had fairly heavy rainfall. One of the things that has happened is that when you get water logging, at times the crops don't do well. In some cases, we've had some of the crops being swept away because of raving floods in a number of areas. If you talk about agriculture, also think about livestock. We've had a number of livestock being swept away by running water in a number of areas in Kenya, and quite a number of people are being displaced. And therefore activities are being impaired for that matter.
You wouldn't say this is in any way related to the El Nino weather pattern, would you?
This is not El Nino related. By the way, they are normally what we call systems that give rise to different weather patterns. There is what we call Madden-Julian oscillation that has been in the phase that normally gives us heavy rainfall for quite some time.
Do you have a specific name for this weather pattern now?
What I've called the MJO, the Madden-Julian oscillation. When it's in a certain phase, normally we get fairly heavy rainfall in East Africa.
For someone who doesn't understand what you're saying, how could you put that out there? How could you explain it for someone to understand that is this going to get serious? Is this going to get worse? Or is this just what it is and it's not going to go beyond that?
No, it's not going to get worse. Normally, as you understand, our long rains last from March up to May. We've had a fairly wet March, also a fairly wet April. We are just getting to March, and the projections are showing that in some areas we might now see a decline in rainfall.
I was speaking to Peter Abenje, Director General of the Institute for Meteorological Training and Research Institute in Nairobi, Kenya.
Keep it to Africa Link. You're listening to DW's Africa Link with me, Jane Ayeko-Kumet.
And I am Abubakar Jallo. Still to come, wine from beetroot. We meet a young Rwandan woman who is changing everything you think you know about red wine.
This wine is charming. It definitely stands up to the other's wine I drink. I had some after the food and it went down nicely. It is a good quality wine. We are proud to say this is made in Rwanda.
Interesting. I would certainly love to taste that wine.
You're going
to
love it. Wait for that.
I'm sure. Anyhow, oftentimes, a mention of Mogadishu evokes imagination of the works of Al-Shabaab, terror, bombs, refugee camps, and destroyed building, especially for those who haven't been there. But a visit to this Somali capital paints a different picture. For the people there, life goes on. The heavy deployment of AMISOM peacekeeping forces in there yields some calmness that enables the people carry on day at a time.
In their quest for peace, Somalis now believe in it's every citizen's responsibility to regain their past economic prosperity and stability. As Frank Yiga finds out, not even drought or famine can stop these people's determination.
Maka al-Mukarrama is the busiest street in Mogadishu capital, with traffic jam, crisscrossing pedestrians and crowded business outlets displaying all sorts of merchandise. It is scorching hot in this city, but it is business as usual. Colonel Osman Abdallah is one of the peacekeepers here, and he shared his experience of living in Mogadishu with me.
You know, if there is no cooperation with the society, you cannot do anything. So now what we have learned from the UPDF is to get the trust of the people. The enemy that we are fighting against is not come from outside. It's a local enemy. So you have to have a connection with your local people.
Hussein Abdel is a translator for AMISOM. He loves his job, but it's risky.
I want to continue my work, but Al-Shabaab sometimes calling me my phone saying, if you not stop work of AMISOM, we kill you. But I don't know what I do.
Leaf Camp is a meeting joint in Mogadishu City where Somalis and foreigners catch up for a drink and chat after a long day's work. Suleiman Elmam is one of the customers here. He has seen the capital progress steadily.
No, Al-Shabaab here in Mogadishu, they do an explosions and things like that. Before, like years ago, they used to control some of the parts of Mogadishu. Now they have their own controllable. So their presence is significant.
I traveled to Bufo, a remote village in Lower Shabelle region, southwest of Mogadishu City. The natives here are livestock farmers in cows, goats, chickens, and camels. Unlike Sulaiman's observation in Mogadishu, 55-year-old Abdallah Bashil tells me Al-Shabaab is still a threat.
The Al-Shabaab don't allow us to learn or even go farming or go anywhere else. They just want us to stay in our homes. That's why we came here at the AMISOM base, to find any form of support like food, security, or even further education. We also want to go back farming. And that's why we can only go where the UPDF are, because in the places, Al-Shabaab refused totally.
They can only get where the UPDF are, because the other people, Al-Shabaab refused totally.
Hadija is one of the women and children lining up to access free medical treatment from AMISOM UPDF soldiers.
I have malaria, headache, fever, and some UTIs.
The soldiers tell me the high turnup of patients is usually overwhelming.
The problem that we get here are diarrheal diseases, malaria, respiratory tract infections, tuberculosis, and diabetes. We normally share these drugs, so in reality the drugs we get are not enough.
Besides receiving free treatment, the people also get food supplies from the soldiers.
When we have some balance of items, some food items, when we get something small, we share with them, most especially the children.
Brigadier General Paul Lokech, the commander of the Ugandan contingent AMISOM Sector 1, says despite the relative peace, Al-Shabaab is still a threat.
There are still some areas that Al-Shabaab are in. We have sectorized the theater. You can clean one sector and then you find the enemy has gone far away in some isolated sectors which has not yet been dominated. That's why we would like to build capacity of the Somali National Forces can help us to move in those areas.
And that report was compiled by Frank Yiga in Somalia.
Africa on the move.
Now, if you enjoy a glass of red wine, you'd usually expect your drink of choice to come from red grapes. But what about red wine made out of beetroot?
Definitely. In Rwanda, one young woman is making red wine out of beets, which grow well there. Business is booming and orders are also coming in from everywhere across the African continent. This report by Inga Sieg is now presented by Isaac Mugabe.
An entire family is helping out at this beetroot plantation, which is run by 28-year-old Assumpta Wamaria. She came up with the idea when she was unemployed and looking for a job.
I became friends with a German who knew how to make wine. I told him I was interested in winemaking, so he taught me how. It all happened over Skype. Once I'd learned enough, I started to experiment with beetroot and pineapple wine.
To make the wine, Assumpta cuts the beetroot into small pieces and boils them. She then leaves it to ferment, resulting in a red wine with 18% alcohol. She says it's important the drink has the right aroma and flavor, but she has just one little problem.
I have a wide range of clients, for example, wedding planners or other event organizers. I can't keep up with the demand. I get so many orders. Most of my clients come from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Some of them buy 300 bottles at once.
About 1,000 bottles go on sale every month, costing the equivalent of almost 10 euros each. But the demand for Karisimbi, the name Assumpta gave her wine, is so high she's planning to increase her production capacity with machines from China. Wine experts like Juvenal Ndaisenga have tested Assumpta's wine.
It's nutritious, healthy, and the quality is consistent.
Anyone who can afford the wine like Stratonda Ruhutse serves their guests Karisimbi.
This wine is charming. It definitely stands up to the others' wine I drink. I had some after the food and it went down nicely. It is a good quality wine. We are proud to say this is made in Rwanda.
Not only has the wine been well received, it has even won a prize for innovation.
Inga Sieg compiled that report and was presented by Isaac Mugabe. See you smiling.
That's a good one, Abu. I can tell you, I feel like testing that wine right away. I mean, you had the man saying it went down nicely after a nice meal. So I guess the next time
I don't think I've ever seen wine from beet or even pineapple, as she mentioned in the report.
But it's the lettuce that people back home are really doing the best. It's really Africa on the move, making the best out of what is within your environment.
That's exactly what we do.
Yeah, if you don't have the grapes, you don't have to wait for them. You make the best out of what you have within your means. Quite interesting report.
Indeed.
Focus Europe.
Now, as France marks the half-century anniversary of May 1968, a profound period of social upheaval, protesters are back on the streets, venting their anger against reforms being pushed through by the year-old centrist government of President Emmanuel Macron.
But from Paris, Lisa Brandt reports the spirit of today's movement is very different from the watershed year that left an indelible mark on French politics and society.
Traditional May Day protests kicked off what many expect will be a month of unrest by angry workers and French students, recalling another tumultuous time 50 years ago.
Boulevard Saint-Germain, les pavés de l'émeute volent.
May 1968 started with student demands for more freedoms. It spread to factories with millions of workers claiming better salaries and jobs. But it was also about bigger issues. Historian and political analyst Nicole Bacharon.
May 68, at the beginning, at the heart, was a revolt against authority, very frozen social hierarchies, and it was all about youth, teenagers finding a place and asking for more personal freedom.
May 68 also fit into a broader context of revolt. Students were marching in the streets of former West Germany and Italy. Americans were protesting against Vietnam and for civil rights. In France, nearly a million people marched in Paris, demanding that the country's aging president and wartime leader, Charles de Gaulle, resign. His party went on to win legislative elections the following month, but a year later, de Gaulle stepped down after losing a referendum. Today, workers are back on the streets. Rail employees are holding rolling strikes against government efforts to overhaul the aging state-owned SNCF railway. And at schools like Nanterre University outside Paris, where the May 68 movement started, students are again barricading buildings and covering walls with graffiti, protesting planned changes to the admission system. Manel Jadoun, who heads Nanterre University's Communist Student Union, says some things are similar to May 68.
We are asking for freedom and more rights for everyone and better quality education. The context is different. We're not in a situation of general strike across France. We hope the situation will change and become even bigger than May 68.
Broader grievances against Macron's reforms were also on display. Health workers, teachers, immigrant rights activists, and anti-capitalists were on the streets. But 69-year-old former Trotskyist Alain Buchana, who joined the protests, says there is something missing in May 2018.
May 68 was a much more collective and general movement, with a much more radical agenda to change politics and government. Today, that's not the case.
Historian Bacharon agrees.
Now, when you see protests in France, it's not about freedom. It's not about changing the world. It's all about security and protection.
May 68 ended one era. France's current president, Emmanuel Macron, is part of the new one. He was not even born until a decade after the uprising. Still, he can expect one continuity, more protests and strikes in the weeks and months to come.
Lisa Brandt with that report.
Now to a rather different story. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has travelled to Britain to see his doctor in a surprise announcement which could renew concerns about whether he's well enough to run the office of the presidency.
And that is something that our listeners, followers and fans have been following on our social media platform. Samson Kanayo says, is this why Buhari wants to remain in Aso Rock by all means so that he will be using state funds for treatment? He is very sick and old. He should go to Daura, his home area, and rest. Now, for those of you who don't know, Aso Rock is the name of Nigeria's state house.
Just a bit of information here that there's also a security conference going on in Maiduguri, which President Buhari was supposed to be chairing, and he's not there.
Yes, certainly. And that has sent people complaining a lot.
And someone said, Sandio Lubisi wrote, his doctor is in Britain? There are no doctors in Nigeria, or he was there to report to the Queen about progress of re-enslaving Nigerians.
Interesting comment there. And China David says, our African doctors are not fit to deal with his sickness. That is what he will say. He is not fit to run for presidency because of his health. Let him concentrate on his health.
And the final one says, from Jato Dolasian, he says, being ill isn't an issue, but what I keep wondering is why a country like Nigeria, with all these resources, can't afford a health institution. Thanks for all your responses.
That's quite interesting, Abu, that people are talking about Buhari and his sickness and all this. Maybe that's a question that we should leave the Nigerians to discuss. And certainly, you too can join the conversation by visiting our Africa page, DW Africa, and keep the conversation going.
Definitely. And from all of us here, my name is Abubakar Jalo.
And I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
Bye now.